The pitchfork that has tines is similar to what we have on the front of the bucket. And these tines have space in between. So if you're a turtle or you're a snake or you're a frog or you're a fish, we're going to see either you in there and we're going to gently put you back in, or you're going to slip through the tines anyway.
Hello and welcome to the Innovative Mindset Podcast. I'm your host, Isolde Trachtenberg. On the show, I interview peak performing innovators in the creative, social impact, and earth conservation spaces. I also bring you ideas and techniques that you can grab and use to set goals, create, and unlock your potential for changing yourself and the world. And now let's get to the show. Hello, and welcome to the Innovative Mindset Podcast. I'm your host, Isolde Trachtenberg. Thank you so much for taking the time to be here today. I am super excited about today's guest. You are going to love learning about what this incredible woman is doing. An accomplished executive, Tara Lordi's vast experience in operations, technology development, and business makes her a force of nature in a traditionally male-dominated industry. With her company, We Do Boats, she aims to keep herbicides and toxic chemicals out of the water using clean, mechanical weed harvesters and cutters. And you know cleaning water is catnip to me, so this is super exciting. In the world today, our natural resources are valued, and Tara seeks out solutions to preserve nature and win the fight to clean aquatic vegetation from the waterways. Tara, I'm so grateful for the work you're doing. Thank you for being here. Welcome.
Well, thank you so much. We're really grateful that you've asked us to be a guest today. And it is a very important topic. And thank you very much for this. I'm excited to help and spread the word and educate on what we're facing today. Precious waterway.
You and I were talking just before we started recording this episode, and I was mentioning that I worked at NASA, and I worked at NASA doing environmental education. A lot of the stuff I did was on the hydrologic cycle, our waterways, the actual water cycle, and what happens to the water, and what happens when water gets to the point where it's no longer a usable part of our natural resources and all of that. And so I particularly appreciate all of the things that you and your company are doing. But I'd like to go back a little bit before we even get into this. I would love it if you would just let me know a little bit about how you came to the realization that water, I know it sounds silly to ask it this way, but that water needs to be clean, that water needs to be available to the aquatic life and to the human life all over the planet. How did that happen for you? What happened to your mindset to make that such a priority for you?
Yeah, thank you for that question, because it is important. I grew up in the Catskill Mountains in the Hudson Valley, New York. And interesting enough, that area, along with my husband growing up in Toronto, we grew up in an atmosphere where being able to jump off bridges into waterways and jumping into lakes and having water and lakes and ponds and streams was part of our natural childhood. And so just having that as a go-to was very important to me, because there wasn't any lake you didn't feel you couldn't jump into and enjoy. And also bass fishing or any type of fly fishing, all of these things are big time part of our upbringing. Also going up to the Adirondacks and enjoying the outdoors. So what happened is we started seeing these little signs, and there was these little signs that say, hey, don't swim for 24 hours. And I said, what in goodness, what is that? And then I look further and I see that they're putting chemicals that cause cellular death into the waterways. And I said, don't swim for 24 hours. I guess they think fish can read. Well, they can't. And I started investigating further. And equally at the same time, my husband was also just as concerned. And he was on the forefront a little faster than I was on the technology, because we realized at that very moment that there were scientists that said it's okay to put pellets or sprays in water to help clean up invasive weeds. And I said, well, if you have to put a sign up that says don't swim for 24 hours, and then you go 24 hours later into that water and you fish that bass fish, or you take your skin and you introduce it to that water, you're going to tell me that's okay? It's causing cellular death. So that was the start of this huge, huge drive to understand what exactly do they feel, the EPA scientists, do they feel is okay to put in water? And that's when I started finding it's not okay. It's really not. And that's very, very scary. And we can go into this in depth, but invasive weeds was the start of what gave me the knowledge to say, hold on a second, we better develop something better. You have toxic algae. That's also something that you'll find where the waters get hotter and you have fertilizers from the ground introducing to the herbicides. Herbicides is notated for things that go in the water. And then we also have other things like fish kill, oil spills, garbage. So these are all contaminants, if you will, or unsightly things that happen to our waterways. But most importantly, the everyday household is going to use those waterways to enjoy life. Lake homes, and swim and need to feel that they can do this without scientists introducing things that will absolutely in the long run hurt them. So that's what started me.
Wow. Yeah. And it's interesting. I mean, while you were talking, I went and the wildlife, the fish themselves need or whatever wildlife there are, you know, reptiles, amphibians, fish, they need the water to be clean, too. And if we have these herbicides in the water, we're obviously damaging the critters that call that water home. So there are lots of different reasons and ideas for needing to keep that water clean. And yet something that you said that it sort of struck me, and I mean, I'm super grateful that you have the mindset that you have. And that I wanted to ask you, though, you said invasive weeds. And I know that in gardening, for example, they say, oh, they're, you know, one person's weed is another person's harvestable edible plant, like a dandelion, right? So how do you define a weed, and how do you define an invasive weed that needs to be removed from a waterway?
So that's a great question, and one that is asked of me by many of my customers. So you have invasives and you have what's called natives. Native species are there to help support the habitat, and they've adapted to living in that particular environment. And that native species might assist you with oxygen. It's a food source. It has a lot of good, good qualities to it. And then there's invasives. Invasives are usually introduced by human or birds. And a lot of invasives have come into our waterways because people thought, let me take this aquarium plant and let me put it into my lake so that I can create a better food chain so I have a better fishing environment. Well, that's a no-no, because you've just introduced something that's not native, and that non-native plant is going to wreak havoc on your waterway. It's not only going to grow very quickly, but it's also going to choke the waterways, inhibit navigational waters, and it's very bad. But what we did develop with WeDo and our boats is we are very big on what's called precision harvesting. Precision harvesting means we're going to go in with the tines, which is almost like a pitchfork on the front of the vessel, and we're going to pluck what's good out of the water, what's invasive out of the water, and leave what's good. And that's really, really important to be able to precisely remove what's bad. And, you know, I'm sorry, but if you're going to blast a bunch of herbicides out at these, the little herbicide molecules don't say, oh, you're good and you're bad. Oh, therefore, I'm going to leave you. That doesn't work that way. Cellular death is cellular death. And it's very important. The native species and in every state throughout the world, we do have both. And it is important to educate yourself on what your particular waterway needs to properly survive.
I love that you said that. It's important to educate yourself. I think an educated person, consumer, customer, activists, whatever, that those are the people that actually will know what's going on and be in the forefront of or on the forefront of doing something about it. I'm curious about something that you said. You were talking about fertilizers, for example, and my best friend is the executive director of a nonprofit that is called Sustainable Chesapeake, and she works a lot with farmers because to sort of help them go into a different place, if you will, with respect to herbicides or fertilizers or weed killers or whatever, to sort of keep the Chesapeake Bay, for example, as healthy as it can possibly be and also make it healthier. So when you're talking about this, you said lakefront properties, for example, how much of that fertilizer and various amounts of runoff are you also dealing with when you are trying to clean up waterways?
Oh, it's really incredible. So when you're a scientist and you're Monsanto or you're one of these large companies that might develop something that they feel is appropriate with the proper doses to eliminate invasive weeds, you are literally doing that. You're not developing a chemical with the forethought that there's introduction of what we have runoff. So if you take a river going downhill, for example, we have something in Florida called Lake Okeechobee, and it starts up in Reedy Creek near Disney. So now think of that river starting up higher and working its way down to a large lake. What's going to happen is they're going to pass through cattle farms. They're going to have phosphates. They're going to pass by people with homes that they fertilize their grass. So that gets introduced. They're going to pass by introductions of industries, chemicals, where they have their offshoot. So you've got to understand that that water is not just taking a very small assay that a scientist developed with an herbicide. They're taking chemical contaminants that essentially become a toxic bloom. And that is where pesticides and herbicides and runoff and phosphates become very scary. And that is not, you can't plan for that. You can't say, well, let me introduce this and it'll be okay, because it won't. People are going to be irresponsible with their spraying. Some weeds will become resistant to the herbicides. Mm-hmm. And I assure you that going down a river, you're not going to control everything that goes into it. So the best thing to do is just stop with the chemicals, completely stop, and turn to alternative means like mechanical removal, so that you can control the chemical contaminants that are being introduced.
Well, you're singing my song, that's for sure. yeah, absolutely. You know, and to me, as I'm listening to you, I'm kind of going, okay, so it's such a complex system, right? This whole notion of when a scientist or whoever creates an herbicide thinking, oh, it's going to kill this one invasive species. But of course, as you said, cellular death is cellular death. Is there a way to, outside of mechanical, because not everyone has adopted mechanical, is there something individual people can do to, because not everyone's going to be able to hire WeDo boats, for example, if they live near a lake, but they have a small plot of land or something like that, they probably won't be hiring WeDo boats to go and clean up their little bit of lakefront property. So is there something the individual person can do? And if so, what is it to mitigate, to amend their practices so that they minimize some of this potential algal blooms and various other issues that crop up if they do use fertilizers?
So there's two parts to that question. And the first part is when you say fertilizers. So if they're using fertilizers in their grass, but they're having an issue with invasive weeds in their pond or lake, they have a few choices. One, put on a little wetsuit, go in there and hand pull. That's completely fine. Just get put on a mask, get yourself some air in a tube, and go in there and you can hand pull those weeds and gently put them into garbage bags. That's what some people actually do. It's still healthy. You're ripping from the root down below. You're not introducing contaminants. That's step one, depending on the size of your lake or pond or waterway. Step two is we're the manufacturers. We don't provide service. We sell boats to others that would provide service. Mm-hmm. And a lot of my customers out there are charging roughly $250 an hour to go in with a pencil. So in a typical eight-hour day, you know, it can get to about $2,000 a day in some areas and maybe cheaper in others. But for the most part, if you have a very, very small waterway, you might just say, hey, for $500 for 2 hours, this boat owner could come in and clean me up and I'm all set.
Okay.
But the chemical introduction has a bigger problem on the long term. And that is when you spray chemicals onto your waterway in an effort to create cellular death and make the weeds go, the only place they can go is the bottom of your lake. You're not removing it. All you're doing is making it so you don't see it on the top of the water. Now what happens after 2 years or 3 years or 5 years or 10 years of spraying is the water depth actually gets reduced because all of that waste is now sitting on the bottom of your lake. Mm-hmm. And now you've got chemical waste sitting on the bottom of your lake. And as the water gets hotter, it becomes even more toxic. Now, after a certain amount of years, you actually lose the body of water. It becomes an island because all of that waste kept getting dumped on the bottom. And then all of a sudden it rises to the top and eventually you have no more water. So between warmer waters and reduction of depth, you're going to be hard pressed to ever get me to agree to an herbicide, nor will any scientist in the world, anyone ever disagree with what I'm saying. You know, it really is. You've got to get it out of there. You want to remove it, not leave it. And so, like I said, hand pulling, if it's small enough, mechanical harvesting, you know, and having somebody to assist you as a service is, if you can't buy a boat, you can at least get a service.
I love that. I think that's a great potential solution. And it's possible people who live on the lakefront, you know, it's not like the weeds stop at your property line. So maybe they could get together with a bunch of people who live in the neighborhood and hire someone or to come in and do this, because this, you know, that's the thing. It's not property lines don't mean diddly when it comes to nature, right? Nature doesn't really care, except for if it's a river and that denotes a property line. So this is one of those times when a community coming together could do something really good for their very specific area. And I love that. And in fact, I remember, it's interesting, I was doing a NASA workshop way back when, and we were on the Miami River, and because of all the heavy metals that were sitting at the bottom, we could only go to a certain depth to get our water samples, because they were like, yeah, you don't want to go past 15 feet or whatever it was, because past that, that's where all the heavy metals are. And it was scary, and we had to wear goggles and gloves and all of this stuff in order to be able to take water samples to test for pH and total dissolved solids and all of that. And so when you're in this moment and you're going, I'm sure it's frustrating for you, beating your head against this particular wall going, stop using herbicides, stop doing this, because it's sitting on the bottom of the water. And I have a better way, right? You've said that. And so can you talk to me and pretend that I'm like 5 years old and explain what makes the mechanical technique better and more innovative than some of these traditional techniques?
Traditionally, they didn't have what we have. Traditionally, they had these huge harvesters and they couldn't get to the shoreline. And most invasive weeds will hang out from the shoreline and up to about 8 feet. And they had these huge harvesters that were hard. They had to crane them in. And so I get it. I get why they started. But let me explain that when you look at invasive weeds, you have to understand how they grow. You need sun, you need soil, and they need to be able to see the sun, right? So you usually only have the shoreline up to about 10 feet where you want to continue to take your equipment, whether it's cutting it or ripping it or pulling it. You want to get those out so that they can't see the sun and continue to grow. And so when we developed our boats, we made them only 12 feet in length. We made them out of fiberglass, which is lighter. We made our cutters so they can cut down 6 feet. We made our front end loaders so they have almost tines so they can precision harvest. We made all of these attachments and we actually designed this vessel literally behind the different invasive weeds my customers fight, So I went out and I said, what do you have? And what do you have? And what do you have? And basically you've got hydrilla, water chestnuts, cattails, you have Eurasian water milfoil, duckweed, water hyacinth. So based on all of these most popular weeds, we started developing really cool attachments to say, hey, you got duckweed. It's almost like sawdust. It's unsightly. Leave a little, but we are going to give you a skimmer bucket. And it looks like a, almost like you're skimming a pool. You're going to go around and skim that and take that out of the water. And so basically we built a vessel that's affordable, small, and allows for what we call shoreline maintenance, because we can launch this vessel in as little as 12 feet of water. And you can operate this vessel in as little as 2 feet of water. Now, you're not going to get that with big harvesters, but we designed our proprietary outdrive system so that we could hover around these very shallow areas. We need water, can't be completely dry, but we can do this in these shallow areas, and we can get ahead of these weeds before they see the sun and they're sitting in wet soil. And that's how we get control using mechanical harvesting. That's it. And that's it in a nutshell. And no one else out there, to be honest with you, I'm sure everybody has some contraptions, which I'm so proud of. And I encourage anything you can do, as long as it's not putting chemicals. And there's other things out there. We just happen to have, we've been out here more than 10 years. We've been out here, you know, trial and tribulation and learn and listen to the clients and hit our head against the wall. So we finally came out within the last, I would say 8 years, we really started to perfect it. And we came out with our latest model in 2021, which had even more attachments and more buoyancy and all sorts of these creature comforts that it's actually makes it fun. Essentially people say, hey, Tara, you're like a skid steer on the water. I'm like, absolutely. So you have customers at the government level, Corps of Engineers, federal government. We have customers at the municipality level. We have customers at the gentleman farmer level. We have customers that are big companies where they want to, you know, keep their intake clear, like you're a utility company and you need water to cool down your intake. We have we're in over 14 countries. So we get introduced to lots of different types of weeds. And that's how we developed all these attachments in order to help. And at this point, no one is really doing exactly what we're doing. So not only are we the leaders, but I think we're the biggest listeners. And I think that's why we're in the position we're in.
I love that you said that you're the biggest listeners, because it sounds to me like you're speaking to your customers and potential customers and finding out what their needs are, boots on the ground, which I think is great. And when you're in that position, what is the process for innovating? Like a customer comes and says, you know, I really want to save all of my cattails. I don't know what someone might want to save or not, but let's say they go, I want to save all my cattails, and they're a tall plant. Right. So how would you innovate figuring out what, if it's more than one customer or whatever, figuring out these attachments? What is the process to make those innovations in the company?
Yeah, great question. So the good news is I have my own welding shop. So I actually, aside from the Kubota engine and a cutter, I actually make nearly everything on the boat. So when somebody says to me, we would like to have a root rake so that we can rip up the root balls of our cattails, but also leave enough for us. So we want some out and some in. We've developed an attachment called a root rake that allows you to get underneath the root balls and remove them or put them somewhere else. If you say, hey, I don't want to remove my cattails, but I want to make them shorter, we have a cutter that's mounted behind the operator that'll allow you to cut them down lower without disturbing them. It won't hurt them, but it'll just reduce the height. So you want them, but you don't want to have to, you know, you want to be able to see over them. And again, this is being, you know, presented with different things. So when a customer calls me and they said, hey, Tara, you know, we've got this lily pads and they're out of control. And when we cut them with the cutter, they come back because spatter duck is that fast. Okay, no problem. So I go in the back. I'm a ride horses. So I went into my ring. I took my drag that I used to drag my ring to ride. And I put it on like a spatula, and I had the guys weld me what I would call the Root Ripper. And it's a little spatula because spatter duck, or AKA lily pads, have these cute little like long roots that are at the bottom. And if you cut it, they're going to come back pretty quickly. But if you put this little device down and you pull backwards with the vessel on this, you'll actually take the roots out. So you can take some out and leave some, again, precision harvesting, but it does allow you to reduce the time that it takes to come back. And in every weed, you've got to really understand it, because blooming is a whole nother subject. For example, eelgrass has little flowers. That's a big one. You'll find your Alabama customers will call you and say, we've got this beautiful lake, but the eelgrass is out of control. Well, it flowers and it blooms. You need to know when your invasive weed has any type of blooming, because if you start chopping it during its blooming, you could spread the seeds. And fragmentation is a big deal. So we developed a product called a skimmer bucket. When you cut, these weeds don't really sink quite yet. They kind of float on top. So we always advise our customers, when you cut, come back through and skim your work so you get those seedlings out so they don't drop to the bottom and create, you know, fragmentation and therefore a thicker, waterway. So again, it's about education. It's about learning what kind of weed you're dealing with. It's about learning when they bloom. Do they bloom? How do they live? What do they grow on? Are they helpful? Are they really invasive? Do I need to, they're native, but they're out of control native. These are all the things you need as a responsible operator or a responsible individual before you tackle this. And even making a phone call to your local DEC office or who's ever your governing body that assists you with management of these type of species, call them and ask them, hey, can you help me? You know, this is what, you know, we are faced with. We know that we could call somebody like we do, but can you educate us on what we should leave? How much of this should we remove and what would be a good thing to leave, because every environment's different. So this is all about education, understanding, and then being able to devise a solution to extract responsibly.
I'm taking a second. You might hear me sometimes pause because I'm sort of synthesizing what you've said and taking it in. Some people call it dead air. I call it anticipatory air. I'm fascinated that it feels to me like you need a degree in horticulture or botany or something in order to be able to do this responsibly. You mentioned a couple different places. Do you have a favorite book or a favorite resource that people could go to? I know, for example, they have like zone one, zone two, zone three in gardening. Is there a invasive species Bible in that way somewhere? And if so, do you know what it is? And if so, where would we find it?
So believe it or not, I had that same question you did. And I found that it was different from state to state. So I tried to find the universities that did studies in it on their botany labs. And I ended up trying to gather my own data. And actually at my website, I developed Worst Weed 1, Worst Weed 2, Worst Weed. So at my website, which is www.weedoobats.com, is our website, We Do Boats, we do have a place where you can actually look at the weed that pertains to you and see a little bit about it. the internet's the best place to go, but I've actually kind of done some homework and said, here's the top, you know, weeds that you're probably going to be faced with. And we've done that. So either check with your universities, check with your local DEC office, check with, like here we have Florida Fish and Wildlife in the state of Florida. You can check with those types. You can go on the internet and search your specific weed. Or you can come to our site or even send us an email, and we'll make sure you have all the necessary resources and education. Because that's very important. And, you know, it's something we really value very highly.
Oh, that's awesome. I appreciate you saying that. And I will definitely have the link to the website in the show notes as well, because yeah, for sure. And, you know, and there are services like the Natural Resources Conservation Service and the USDA and things like that. NRCS has offices in just about every county of every state. So there are people you might be able to also reach out to and find information if Tara's documentations do not have the thing that you see in your waterway. there could be because you said that they were the worst, but maybe not the only in the files that you've developed, which is, I think, is great that you've developed them. I think that's terrific because, you know, there are so many things that, and weeds, invasives grow fast. I have noticed that they are just one day there's nothing there, and the next day they're 4 feet high, and you're like, how did that happen? My goodness. So there's, it's really important if you know what you don't want to have, if you know it's an invasive species and it's not something that's going to benefit the ecosystem you're in, it behooves you to figure out what it is and to also figure out how to get rid of it responsibly. But I did want to ask you something, Tara. You said putting weeds carefully in a trash bag, which I think is great, except for what happens to the weeds themselves after you're done harvesting them? Where do they go? Like, are they composted, and are their seeds then going to go back into the ecosystem and become part of a life cycle again? Or is there some way to make sure that they don't become an invasive species just 10 miles downriver?
So, yeah, when we... our customers typically remove weeds. They'll put it on the shoreline. They'll let it dry out for a day or so. Then they'll get a grappler, or they'll just take bags, or they'll use a shoreline conveyor to go into a truck to be removed from that lake. That truck then goes to proper disposals. Most states have at their normal garbage dumpsters, they have a vegetation area where you can do removal. So it really depends on what the weed is and if it's been treated with herbicides. If it's been treated with herbicides, I would remove it responsibly with the proper sanitation company that handles vegetation removal in your area. They may burn it. I'm not really sure what they're doing with it, or you might want to burn it yourself. But yes, if it hasn't been treated, in the Northeast, I find that a lot of people will use these plants to put around their apple trees to keep them warm for the winter. They could use them to properly do things with. It really depends on what the weed is and if it's been treated with herbicides. Otherwise, if it has been treated, yes, there is, responsible sanitation companies usually that I've seen in state to state and county to county.
Awesome. Thank you. Yeah. And as a vegan, I'm going, don't feed anything to critters that has been, you know, that's borrowing all sorts of trouble and making things more challenging for all the beings. I did want to ask you something else. Some of these things that you're, and I don't know the answer at all because I don't know the ins and outs of this, but some of these algal blooms, some of the stuff that will, because of the rising water temperatures, that will show up in shorelines and in water bodies, there's all sorts of nitrogen and phosphorus and potassium issues with some of this, not to mention the beneficial plants don't get enough sunlight at the bottom of the water if there's an algal bloom. How does the process of mechanical harvesting of some of these affect the sort of the viability of nitrate, nitrogen, and phosphorus that are so necessary in some ways to plants? And the other side of that coin being that it could be actually dangerous depending on how much there is in the water.
So there's a couple different type of algae blooms, right? You have red algae, which is something that's happened for a long time. It's something that's natural. But then you have what's called blue-green algae, which we faced very badly here in Florida where the waters are hot. And this is a result of fertilizers mixing with herbicides, mixing with the phosphates, as we discussed before. That is extremely harmful, and it's toxic. I've heard people in Port St. Lucie that they actually had cases when they let Lake Okeechobee Dam go and they used the water to flow from the dam, from the Lake O into the ocean, and they went through these different waterways and canals. I've actually heard about people becoming very sick. Cancer was a factor, and some others. So you want to get that out. If it happens and it's there, you want to use the skimmer bucket and get it out of there. You want to use proper respirators. You want to make sure that you have hazmat tanks, and you want to absolutely remove that. That's terrible, terrible, terrible. The red algae is something that's a little more natural. So just when we're talking about algae, you just have to know kind of the origin. It has an antioxidant activity to it, the red algae, but you also don't really want it in your waters because it has harm, and it does produce toxins that kill fish and make shellfish dangerous to eat. So we're not causing but most red algae were natural. That's happened for a while, but you want it out because of the toxins. But the blue-green algae, that's all human. That one, that's all our fault. That's a bad one. And in both situations, a simple skimmer bucket is a perfect way. We were just actually in a big press release. We had a big municipality here in Florida buy a few of our vessels to combat the red tide. And they said, you know, this is fantastic. They were so excited. They put a big press release out for their county, and it was very exciting to them. And they believe that they have the necessary tools to combat this. So we're very excited that we have the ability to fix it, but we want people to understand that it isn't just about removal. It's about, again, responsible removal. Use a respirator, use the proper gear to get it out of there. Don't put yourself in harm's way. But yes, you definitely want to understand what it is and how to get it out of there.
Yeah, thank you for saying that. There's so much education involved in this, and we're often right on the water's edge, and we're mucking about with things we don't understand. And I don't mean just, you know, you, me, or another individual person. I mean humans. We often mess with things we don't understand, and before we make things any better, we make things a lot worse. So this is one of those things that, as humans introduce invasive species, for example, they can then do something about it responsibly, and that is fabulous. I am wondering something, if you could answer this question real quick before we move on to the next part. What about the critters that are already living in the waterway? Like, when you're doing this mechanical harvesting and pulling things, how do you responsibly sort of not mess with the critters that are already there?
So I can actually give you this answer because I have proof of this. Lake Okeechobee had, as we were discussing before, a very big problem with biomass buildup, herbicide spraying, everything coming down from Rita Creek all the way down. So the Corps of Engineers and a couple other different FWC and a couple other entities had asked us to come in with some vessels just as a proof of concept. Mm-hmm. And one of the biggest things they said, well, we're going to have this bycatch. There's going to be a whole host of problems associated with the frogs and the snakes and what we're going to see. So we set up shop on one part of the lake at Lake O. We had an excavator standing by. We had barges, and we had these vessels out on the water. And we had a couple people from FWC, as well as I think I saw two other scientists, just an independent scientist. And they put a little tent out and they set up shop. And I don't know how much tonnage we took out, but I assure you we were there for 7 days straight. So you can imagine how much tonnage. And not only did we not get any bycatch whatsoever, but we even got one little dragonfly that landed and flew off. And the reason being, it's great. The reason being is because we have tines. So if you think of a pitchfork, the pitchfork that has tines is similar to what we have on the front of the bucket. Hmm. And these tines have space in between. So if you're a turtle, or you're a snake, or you're a frog, or you're a fish, we're going to see either you in there and we're going to gently put you back in, or you're going to slip through the tines anyway. And that's what's so beautiful about this vegetation bucket, is that we don't have bycatch. And after 7 days doing a demonstration for the Corps of Engineers, I assure you, I can say with 100% certainty that an irresponsible operator has zero bycatch.
That is awesome to hear. I love that. That makes me so happy, because it means that you have been very specific and very smart about how you've developed this technology. And I actually would like to ask you something that is a little bit off what we've been talking about, and that is One of the things that I mentioned earlier about you is that this is a traditionally male dominated field, and you're a woman at the head of a company who's doing this work. And I'm wondering if you wouldn't mind speaking a little bit to how does that influence how you operate and innovate when you're a woman working in this traditionally male dominated field?
Yeah, I've grown up my whole life as an athlete. I was a professional show jumper as a young lady. And then I went into Wall Street and I worked in banking, which was also male dominated. And then I went from banking into my own company and lived in India for a while. And then I went from that, was developing disqualification logic for banks. And then I went from that to going and playing polo, also male dominated. So I've been in essentially male-dominated sports or professions my entire life. And I can give you two words to summarize every experience I've ever had. And it's called functionally elegant. The more functionally elegant you are as a human being, man or woman, the more functional, the better you will be. As a woman, I embrace my femininity, but I also embrace my functionality. And I don't feel that being successful has to do with your gender. It has to do with your ability to make an impact and have the ability to get along with others. And if you can do that and you stay focused and you're detail oriented and you stand behind what you believe in and you create a team that agrees with your philosophy, then I believe you can steer your ship through functional elegance and really be successful.
That's fabulous. What a great answer. Thank you so much for that. Tara, I am super grateful that you took the time to be here. And I know you're going to come back for the little bonus episode, but I have just one more question that I would love to ask you. And before I do, I wanted to ask you to, I know you've already mentioned the website. Is there any other social channel that people might find out more about WeDo? Is there anything else, any other channel, Instagram or YouTube or anything like that, that someone could go, oh, I want to know more about this, and then I could put the link in the show notes?
Absolutely. We have a YouTube channel, which features a lot of our videos, as well as some of our customer videos. We have a group called We Do Boats Official. We Do Boats Owners Official. I can give you that link. That is where you'll see a lot of our customers share really cool experiences, maybe things that they did to combat their weeds. We also have an Instagram, a Twitter account, as well as TikTok and LinkedIn. So we're featured in multiple social media avenues, as well as our website and, most importantly, the YouTube channel.
Awesome. That's great. So what we'll have to do is put all of those in the show notes so that people can go and link to them or find them and take a look at the thing. And also, especially that invasive weed document that you've created, which I think is great. Again, I'm super grateful that you took the time to be here. This is so educational and so necessary. You're doing critical work on behalf of the ecosystems and the biomes of the planet. I think amazing. And I have just, as I said, one last question before we break for the bonus episode. And the question is this: if you had an airplane, environmentally friendly, of course, that could skywrite anything for the whole world to see, what would you say?
I had an airplane
That could skywrite anything for the whole world to see, what would you say?
I would say, do what you can during your lifetime to give back to the very planet that you lived on, and make sure that that is on the forefront of your mind. And I don't care if it's picking up a gum wrapper. I don't care if it's doing something as strong as helping the ocean and its issues with debris. Whatever it may be, we have to give back. We don't have a choice. You can't live on a planet and not take it back. So I'd like to shout out to everyone. I don't care what it is, but make sure whatever you do in your own way, you give back to the very place you were raised on.
That's beautiful. That's awesome. Ah, thank you so much, Tara. That's a terrific answer. I've asked this of hundreds of people because I ask it at the end of every episode. And I love, do what you can for the home you live on. I think that's great. So Tara, again, thank you so much for joining me on the show. You're going to come right back for the bonus episode, which I'm really grateful for too. But let me say goodbye now. And this is Isolde Trachtenberg for the Innovative Mindset Podcast, reminding you as always that you can find me at isoldet.com. You can find the podcast at podcast.isoldet.com. And you can also, I would love it if you would check out my latest book, Die by the Sword, which just came out this week. Or actually, by the time this episode airs, it came out a couple months ago. But you know what I mean. Die by the Sword is out. It's going to make a great holiday gift. Until next time, this is again Isolde Trachtenberg for the Innovative Mindset Podcast, reminding you to be bold, be creative, and most of all, be kind. Thank you so much for joining me today. I really appreciate you being here. Please subscribe to the podcast if you're new, and it would mean the world to me if you told a friend about it. Today's episode was produced by Isolde Trachtenberg and is copyright 2022. As always, please remember this is for educational and entertainment purposes only. Past performance does not guarantee future results, although we can always hope. Until next time, remember to be bold, be creative, and most of all, be kind. Thank you.